You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, this is Jay Shapiro. We're in the middle of a war right now, but we've learned a lot since October 6th, and a lot of people are making comments about what we have learned. There are big arguments between all the Israeli generals and all the philosophers about how we got into this war, and what we do when the war ends, and how will the war end, and what will we do with Gaza, with all the hundreds of thousands of Arabs there, and so forth. It's become a very, very big issue here in Israel. But among all the people who speak on television and write in the newspapers, I've managed to discover those who make sense the most. And I'd like to share with you some thoughts, particularly by Micha Goodman, who essentially is a philosopher, as I understand it. I've read a few of his books, and he is analyzing what the results of the war so far are. And he begins by saying that there are many different kinds of hatred. In racist societies, they hate people because of their skin color. In homophobic societies, they hate people because of their sexual orientation. And in polarized societies, there is a jump in a very specific kind of hatred. People hate people because of their political opinions. Now, that is a very serious problem, and we see in particular, if we follow the news, that in the United States, there is a tremendous amount of dispute, and over the years, it seems that a certain form of thinking has taken place in the universities, and it's not healthy for the society, because the philosophies that are being taught in universities are really dividing the society rather than pulling it together. Now, disagreements do not necessarily have to lead to hatred. However, according to Micha Goodman, he notes that we are not living in an ideal world. The digital revolution created a reality where ideological division transforms into emotional division. In this new reality where disagreement prevails, so do hatred and disgust. In other words, we are no longer able to disagree and still get along. It turns out what's happening in the world today is the very act of disagreeing divides us from those people with whom they disagree. In the past, right-wingers in the U.S. and Europe opposed the concept of left-winger ideology, but they didn't cancel left-wingers personally. There was no personal hate between those who disagreed philosophically. You could despise someone else's ideology, but you could still get along with the person who proposed this ideology. However, in a polarized society, it's hard to rule out a competing ideology without cancellation of those who believe in it. In other words, you don't simply dislike what a person thinks, but you dislike the person himself because of what he thinks. Each side attributes evil intentions and negative characteristics to the other side. So it's not just a disagreement about ideas, but as soon as you disagree with someone's idea, you disagree with his personality also. That's what's happening in the world today. And this is something that Micha Goodman has taken note of. A poll was conducted in the United States back in the 60s, and Americans were asked whether it would bother them if their son or daughter married someone with the opposite political opinion. the Republicans were asked if they would bother them if their children married who supports the Democratic Party, and Democrats were asked if they would want their child, who would they be opposed to their child marrying somebody from the other political party. In the 60s, according to the results, just 4% of the respondents were bothered if their child married somebody with a different political belief. However, in recent years, this poll was conducted again, and the responses changed radically. Today, it would bother more than 50% of Americans if their children married someone from the other side of the political divide. 50 years ago, it was 4% were bothered. Today, more than 50% are bothered simply by differences in politics. Now, this has a lot of implications. If 50% oppose marriage between parents belonging to different political camps, that means half the American citizens identify such marriage as a form of intermarriage. In other words, today, if you marry somebody with a different political belief in the United States, it's a form of intermarriage. In the past, this term, intermarriage, was reserved for marriage between members of different religions. Today, it applies to marriage between those who have different political opinions. So following the digital revolution, more and more people look at people from the opposing political camp and view them as different breed of human beings. In other words, politics has come to play a greater role in society than it did 50 years ago. Now, what happened here in Israel with the recent war? Many people, 300,000 people, showed up for reserve duty. In the reserve forces, hatred was wiped out and replaced with camaraderie, heroism, solidarity. I know myself and my own family, we had 14 of my grandchildren were called into the service, and they served together with people of totally different opinions and totally different attitudes toward religion, but they serve and they work and they fight together. The war brought us together. So Goodman goes on to point out that when a virus spreads through the population, a lot of people get sick. But there are differences between the patients based on the level of sensitivity to the disease. Some suffer from mild symptoms, and others are less likely, and they get worrisome symptoms. Sometimes people, if there's a disease going around, some people get severely ill and others don't. Now, the plague of polarization is a global pandemic spreading throughout the world and harming multiple societies. There are differences between societies depending on the degree of sensitivity and vulnerability. Now, the state of Israel, it would seem, is a particularly vulnerable society. When Israeli society catches a virus, it gets a severe case. And before this war, back a year ago, the country was torn apart politically. There were even members of the heroes of the army who said they would not serve if called up because of their political differences with the government. All this was before October. During the 9 months of conflict before the war, that there was 9 months of conflict over judicial legislation, and the country became completely polarized. Disagreement on the ideological level became hatred on the emotional level. and it blocked any ability for cooperation and between the various domestic camps. And Israel's enemies saw this. They saw this as a weakness, and it whetted their appetite to attack Israel. So the polarization was damaging to Israel's society. What happens in a polarized society is whatever someone feels toward any given ideology becomes what they feel personally toward the person who holds that ideology. The person who's worried about a left-wing ideology starts to think very bad thoughts about people who hold left-wing positions. The person who fears the ideology of the right starts to develop feelings of disgust toward people who hold right-wing positions. Now, there's an explanation for this phenomenon. Michael Goodman pointed out, I find it very interesting. A person infected by this virus looks at another person and actually stops seeing that person. They can only see their political opinion, which defines the person completely. He's no longer a person. He's a walking political opinion. Imagine, for example, a shy person who likes tennis, is a good cook, has a strange sense of humor, who holds a left-wing position. In a polarized society, this person becomes only one thing, a left-winger. All the other characteristics of the person become non-important. All the others see is his political position. This one detail, this political, consumes the entire image of the person, masking the full diversity of their personality. And when a person becomes their opinion, whatever I feel toward their opinions, what I feel toward them. In other words, it's pointed out, you become your opinion today in modern society. So the and this brings tremendous polarization. So the question is, how can polarization be healed? There's a recipe with three ingredients. Bring together people with different opinions over a long period of time. When this happens, people discover all of each other's entire dimensions, not just their political opinion. They find out, for example, that a person's right-wing characteristic reflects who they are far less than their sense of humor or their hobbies and their social skills. In other words, a person's political opinion does not define the person. The big problem we're having in society today, in particular Western society, in the United States, for example, are people are defined by their political opinion. When this happens, when we get away from this, begin to see a world of the person before us, and we see it's broader and richer than their political opinion. In other words, they're no longer masked by their political opinion. And when a person's politics return to their proper place, what we feel toward the other's opinion ceases to be what we feel toward the person himself. Political opinion becomes secondary. So what happened now in Israel? The country for 9 months was under tremendous strife having to do with the Supreme Court. When war broke out, more than 300,000 Israelis were called up to the reserves. They convened in units and companies where Israelis with different opinions and different identities stood shoulder to shoulder in the most intensive way imaginable, face to face over a long period of time. They underwent a detoxification workshop. And when you're in the army, and I can notice my own personal experience, it's a very intimate form of life. when you have people who are stuck together in the same vehicle, particularly, for example, in a tank, it's different than normal life. Everything in your life becomes personalized with the people together with you. So what happened was the result, because of this war, because of the reserve, people going into reserves, hatred was wiped out and replaced with camaraderie, heroism, and solidarity. So the reserve forces in Israel became essentially the new melting pot of Israel. With all of Israeli society stood together against our enemy, the war brought out the best in the people of Israel. The people right now don't have the ability to withstand stupid, now have the ability to withstand stupid disputes. There's no room for that. All the air is directed toward winning the war, extending a hand to our brothers and sisters fighting on our fronts. So the tragedy that occurred in the Gaza Strip last week, in which 21 soldiers were killed, reminds us of the high price the reservists pay, how greatly indebted we are to them. Now, it stops us from quarreling. From a psychological and sociological standpoint, the reserve forces succeeded in creating a community that scarcely exists today in the entire Western world. This kind of community has two qualities that do not usually come together: diversity and cohesion, which seem to be the opposite of each other, diversity and cohesion. Usually, where there is political diversity, there's no cohesion. And where there's cohesion, there's no diversity. Before this war, during a nine-month period, whenever we saw a cohesive group, we knew with a high level of certainty that this was a homogeneous group whose members all held the same view. People came out to support the government or to oppose the government, but when you saw a large amount of people demonstrating, you knew exactly where they stood. By the way, there's something that's very interesting about Israel. I added as parenthetically, and I actually saw this in Jerusalem. I live near the capital. I live near the Knesset. And people would come out with Israeli flags, and they would be, let's say, for or against the judicial change, and they would demonstrate. And then when they went home, they would give their flags to those coming in to do the opposite demonstration. There was no violence, which I think is very interesting about Israeli society. Whenever we saw a high degree of diversity, we knew there was no cohesion. This happened within families. There were people, before this war began, last year, Passover, there were families who couldn't sit together around the Passover Seder table because of their difference in politics. And then the war broke out, and the reserve forces appeared and presented to Israeli society a model of community that breaks all the invisible rules created by the so-called digital revolution. This is a community that is diverse and cohesive at the same time. There is diverse in their thinking, and they're cohesive in their feeling toward their fellow Jews. During the period that preceded independence in the state's first years, many Israelis viewed the kibbutz as a model Israeli society. They looked at the communal, egalitarian, and pioneering lifestyle of the kibbutz, and it was very inspiring. The egalitarian nationalist tendency that characterized many Israelis during the early years of the state came a lot from inspiration from the kibbutz. However, by the 90s, Israelis no longer inspired by the kibbutz. During that period, high-tech startups started popping up one after another. At the beginning of the 21st century, these new companies made great strides, presenting a new kind of model. Israelis looked at how a few entrepreneurs dreamt a dream together, set out to realize it. They demonstrated innovation, boldness, and creativity, and that was very inspiring. The inspiration now came from high tech and not from the kibbutzim. In the past, tourists and volunteers came from all over the world to Israel to get to know the kibbutz. Since the beginning of this century, tourists and groups throughout the world arriving in Israel to learn about high tech. Years ago, they came to see what a kibbutz was like. Now they come to see what Israeli high tech is like. The kibbutz in those days represented what was special about Israeli socialism. Today, startup companies represent what is special about Israeli capitalism. So we went from a socialist state to a capitalist state. So now, according to Micha Goodman, who is an observer of society, a new updated model society was born, which is the reserve forces. The model society in Israel is the reserve forces. Hundreds of thousands of people come together with very diverse backgrounds in many cases, and they work and they fight together. These communities are not a model of socialist ideology like the kibbutz. They're not a model of capitalist ideology like high tech. These are model communities that symbolize the ability to rise above ideology. When we look up to something, we change. Society looks up to rich people, a society that's materialistic. Society looks up to sports, probably an athletic society. A society that looks to intellectuals is probably a society with a high level of literacy. A society that looks to generals is probably one with military tendencies. What we admire changes us. Some of its qualities of that which we admire become a part of us. So what does a society that looks up to reserve forces with wonder and admiration look like? That's a very interesting question. When we look up to how the reservists make sacrifices, we also breathe in part of their unity and cohesion. So now what we have is a new model community, or it's an unplanned byproduct of this war. These are communities made of thousands of reservists, male and female, who left their homes to fight against Israel's enemies. And in fact, are bringing peace within Israel. That's what's most interesting about this. We have more inner peace in Israel because of this war than we had before. Our society was falling apart before this war. Now our society is coming together. And that is a fantastic thing. And a philosopher like Micha Goodman has pointed this out. I've done a lot of reading over the past few weeks, the summations of the war and the meaning of this war, and Micha Goodman has the most interesting understanding of what happened. Our society has been brought together by this war more than it ever was before. So that is the good that is coming out of this war. It's hard to say good coming out of a war, but that exactly is what's happening. So and when this is all over, I think we're going to be a much better society than we have been since the very beginning. And in the beginning, when the state of Israel was first founded, everyone came together, and it was great, but then we began to fall apart, and now we're coming together again. And unfortunately, it's a war that brought this about. I want to change the subject to something having to do with the present date. This week began a new month. It's Adar Sheni, the second month of Adar in the Hebrew calendar. It's a lunar month. But it's also Ramadan in the Muslim calendar. The Ramadan is a religious month, and it's intended by the religious as a month of charity, fasting, and prayer, and reflection. In general, religious Muslims do not eat during the day, and as soon as the sun goes down, they have big celebrations. I used to work in the northern part of Jerusalem, which has a very large Arab population, and as soon as it was dark, they began to have parties all over the place, something very interesting. Now, by the way, during the war back in Yom Kippur, 1973, it happened during the month of Ramadan, and the Egyptian and Syrian soldiers were given an exemption from fasting because they were engaged in their religious duty of killing infidels. Infidels includes Jews. So the Ramadan has been used to murder Jews. Back in 2016, Hamas labeled an attack on the Sirona market in Tel Aviv the Ramadan operation, and other attacks on Jews would take place during Ramadan. It's not even limited to Jews. In 2016 and 2017, ISIS, the terror group, bombed a popular street in Baghdad during Ramadan, killing hundreds of Muslims. During that same Ramadan in 2016, a radical Muslim attacked a nightclub in Orlando, Florida, killing 49 people. Arabs have historically fought vicious wars against each other during Ramadan. Sure enough, we are now entering Ramadan, and everybody's getting nervous about escalation, especially since Hamas is talking about doing things during this month. The defense establishment in this country is warning Israeli leaders to pay deference to Ramadan. You have to be extra cautious during Ramadan, to do nothing to provoke Muslims on Ramadan, especially in and around Jerusalem's Temple Mount, because Muslim emotions are very sensitive during the month of Ramadan. U.S. President Joe Biden even has gone as far that Israel, he says that Israel should halt its war against Hamas to allow Muslims to observe Ramadan. So these sentiments are bizarre. It's interesting that we should suddenly respect the Arab Ramadan, even though they murdered Jews, and now we're fighting them to save Jewish lives. It's inconceivable to any Jew to use a religious reason to murder or rape or shoot or stab. Maybe good Muslims should use this Ramadan for soul searching, how to best to uproot the evil from their midst. Now, it's the soft bigotry of low expectations that so-called security experts and diplomats say tensions always run high during Ramadan, and therefore Jews should keep a low profile because Muslim violence may be anticipated during the month of Ramadan. truth of the matter is, this kind of a sentiment insults the majority of the world's Muslims. You don't surrender to bullies, you confront them and vanquish them. By the way, Indonesia is a Muslim country, and they don't behave the way our neighbors here in the Middle East do, the Muslims. Right now, this week, the government of Israel was having all kind of urgent consultations and whether to impose anti-riot limits on Arab visitors to the two Muslim shrines on the Temple Mount. There are threats now that during the month of Ramadan, Muslims come from all over the world to visit the Temple Mount, and that presents a tremendous problem for Israel, a security problem. Now, the custodian of the Temple Mount is Jordan. Back in the Six-Day War, 1967, Jordan was handed over the custodianship for the Temple Mount. And they describe Israeli visits to the Temple Mount as violent incursions and as Judaization of Jerusalem and the Muslim holy sites. In other words, we gave them the right to control the mount, and they look upon visits of Jews as incitement. And not only that, they have been unilaterally, brazenly, and violently changed the status quo in the Temple Mount over the past 25 years. The mount has become a base of hostile operations against Israel instead of protecting it as a zone of prayer and peace. Israel, on the other hand, has acted with utmost restraint in the face of Arab assaults. The Islamic Trust is called the Waqf, W-A-K-F, and the Waqf, an Islamic movement, provocateurs have attacked Jewish visitors to the Temple Mount. They've attacked Jewish worshippers at the Western Wall, below the mount, and they've attacked Jewish worshippers on their way to the Western Wall. It's interesting also, people have come from Bahrain and from the Emirates to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, but are now being attacked because those countries signed Abraham Accord peace treaties with Israel. They've greatly restricted visitation rights to the Holy Mount for all non-Muslims, and they preach hatred and violence against Israel. The Waqf also conducted vast illegal construction projects on the mount, and they've destroyed, purposely, centuries of Jewish archaeological treasures. As a matter of fact, 400 trucks full of archaeologically rich rubble were dumped by the Waqf into the Kidron Valley. Thousands of artifacts from the temple periods have been found in this rubble. I myself have gone down there. The Muslims cleared out all what they thought had Jewish association with the Temple Mount. They took it out in trucks. They dumped it into the Kidron Valley. And now there are people, thousands of people, who come and sift through this rubble to find things of Jewish value. So they still take a campaign against the authenticity of Israel's historic rights to Jerusalem. The propaganda put out by the Palestinian Authority is that the Jews have no rights nor any historical attachment to the Temple Mount. So even well-meaning Western spokesmen like the State Department have fallen victim to the big lie. And We have to worry about the sanctity of the holy sites. The violence in Jerusalem has escalated only by one side, the Arab side, and over the past 25 years. It's the Palestinians who have turned Al-Aqsa, the entire Mount Plaza, into extraterritorial headquarters for propagation of lies about Israel. In fact, Palestinian violence and Islamic exclusivism has become the new Temple Mount status. So the truth of the matter is that the government of Israel seems to be very helpless. Even now, when Hamas and its allies in Judea and Samaria are at war with Israel, Israeli leaders continually prefer to keep things quiet and do what they call restore calm after every wave of Palestinian assault. And they seem to forget that the so-called status quo is really dead. So we are now in the month of Ramadan, and hopefully it will be peaceful, but it's hard to know whether it will be. It's interesting, by the way, it was pointed out that even though the Jordanian deny and downplay the October attacks, Jordanian parliament is vicious anti-Israel rhetoric. Jordan wants an additional 50 million cubic meters of water over and beyond the amounts Israel's obligated to provide under the 1994 peace treaty. Very interesting. Jordan is a country that has no water, and in the 1994 peace treaty, Israel agreed to give millions of cubic meters of water to the Jordanians just to keep them alive. So, and Jordan also essentially controls the Temple Mount. So we have a very odd situation between Jordan and Israel, and particularly regarding the Temple Mount. So the reason I brought this all up is because we're now in the beginning of Ramadan, which is the holy month, and there's some possibility that there will be violence here in Jerusalem. Hopefully and prayerfully there will not be, but knowing with the conditions here in Jerusalem, the fact that we're already in a war, this is a very, very sensitive time. And Jerusalem is a very, very sensitive place, and hopefully it won't get out of control. But I just wanted the listeners to be aware of the sensitivity of the situation. Jerusalem has always been a sensitive place because it's holy to the major religions, Muslim, Islam, Christian, and Jewish. And at a time when we're at war in Gaza, Jerusalem becomes an even more sensitive place. So hopefully it will be a peaceful month, but I just want the listeners to be aware of what's happening here and know that we here in Israel have to really keep our guard up to see to it that the citizens of Israel and the people living here, including the Arabs, are safe. The last thing we need is an extension of the war that's happening now in Gaza to local areas like Jerusalem. It's a sensitive time, and hopefully we will come out of this okay. I'll be back after the break.
Shalom, this is Nadia Matar from the Sovereignty Movement. At a time when there is so much disinformation, you have to know who to listen to know what really is going on in Israel. Israel News Talk Radio is the radio where you can know that what you hear is the truth.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You think you can get real news about Israel
from major news sources located far away from Israel?
Think again.
Get it from the source.
Israel News Talk Radio. Straight talk from Israel.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to say a few words about one of the great disappointments in my lifetime. I don't mean a personal disappointment. I mean the United Nations. I remember when I was a kid, right after the Second World War, the League of Nations was replaced by the United Nations, and there was a tremendous amount of publicity about the fact that after Germany and Japan had been defeated, the forces of evil had been defeated, and now the world would get together, replaced the League of Nations by, which had failed, of course, and replace it by the United Nations, which is supposed to bring a new, happy world. Well, in my own lifetime, I've seen this whole thing turn into a terrible failure. And the worst of all is the UNRWA, which is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which is a UN agency dealing only with the Palestinian refugees. All the refugees in the world, and there are hundreds of thousands of them, are dealt with by different UN organizations. But the UNRWA is only for the Palestinians. It turns out that employees, including teachers and school staffers of UNRWA in Gaza, were actively involved in the October 7th massacre. Some of the UNRWA teachers were terrorists, which should have triggered moral outrage, yet somehow the world remains quiet. Now, also, they discovered that Hamas's main data center was underneath an UNRWA office, the entry to which was on the grounds of an UNRWA school. The world has said nothing about that. Much of the educational model of the UNRWA schools in the Palestinian areas have been ideologically terrorist. This has been known for some time. Now, what's happened is we now know that Palestinian students studied in buildings storing weapons and used as entrances to Hamas military facilities. Now, this should have caused an uproar around the world. Yet, those who claim to care so much about equality and education, and those who are over-obsessed all kinds of educational theories, were nowhere to be seen. They did not care that the UN educational facilities were used pretty much as the headquarters and the storage areas for terrorism. Now, there is no doubt that education is what, in the final analysis, describes a society. The way we educate our kids, is the way that they'll grow up, in the way that they will form a society. And yet, early education can profoundly influence the way we think and the way we act in the future. It's hypocritical to claim that you care for what children think, but then you ignore proof that UNRWA schools not only indoctrinate children, educate children to hate Jews, and to glorify murderous martyrdom, but you allow these schools to become the sheltering place for weapons to be used against Jews. UNRWA was established in 1949, particularly to serve the Palestinian refugees who were displaced during the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. I don't remember the exact number. I think there were several hundred thousand were displaced. Now, this agency is only for the Palestinians. Now, this is a very narrow focus, and it contrasts sharply with other United Nations agencies. For example, there's something called the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, which serves all other refugee populations around the world. However, from the very beginning, UNRWA's mission was only dealing with the Palestinians. It inherited a list of aid recipients from its predecessors. There was no clear definition of what constitutes a genuine refugee. So it invented its own definition, which stands in complete contrast to that definition used by all other United Nations bodies. Even Arabs who resided in Palestine for only 2 years before the war in 1948 were classified as refugees if they came to live in Palestine from 1946 on, 2 years before the war. Their children, their grandchildren, and all future generations are defined as refugees. The result is that the number of refugees whom UNRWA serves, which was 700,000 in 1950, has ballooned to almost 6 million refugees today. Well, the rehabilitation and resettlement of these refugees was removed from UNRWA's role. Rather, the Arab world has been using them as a weapon against Israel by keeping them in perpetual refugee status, pending a return to the Jewish state. In other words, they're kept there as refugees in the fifth generation already, so that somehow they can get back and destroy Israel. Now, in the areas controlled by UNRWA, the education system reflects this mentality of victimhood and determination to overturn the outcome of the 1948 war and to undermine the very existence of the State of Israel. In other words, you have an organization whose whole goal, whose whole aim is to destroy the State of Israel. It's as simple as that. Now, UNRWA's extensive educational system employs over half of all the UNRWA staff and oversees almost 185 schools in the Gaza Strip alone. Despite UNRWA's claims to be the primary provider of aid to the Palestinians, UNRWA lacks a proper system of accountability. It does not recognize Hamas as a terror organization and appears to have often worked closely with Hamas authorities ruling Gaza, which includes allowing the diversion of much aid that's supposed to go to help these so-called refugees, are going directly to the fighters of Hamas. Now, there have been a number of reviews by all kinds of specialized bodies, something called like UN Watch, for example. They have exposed hate-filled educational materials in UNRWA schools that directly promote violence and jihad against Israel. A good friend of mine, David Bedin, has spent years. He has sent people into the Gaza area. They've evaluated the school system. They've taken examples of the school books used by the kids in Gaza. David has made a number of presentations at the Israeli Knesset. So the fact that UNRWA, a UN organization, is essentially the educational system that's providing an education to hate Jews to the Palestinians is a known fact and has been known for years. Now, the European Parliament has expressed concern over UNRWA's educational materials for years. Back in 2020, a European Parliament resolution denounced UNRWA's material and said that EU funding would be conditional on adherence to standards of peace, tolerance, coexistence, and nonviolence, and non-propagandizing and educating against Israel. All kind of resolutions were passed in 2021, 2022, 2023. Nonetheless, UNRWA has failed to implement any changes whatsoever. UNRWA is used to educate the kids of Palestine to hate the Jews and to work toward the destruction of the state of Israel. It's as simple as that. A UN agency is being used to promote the destruction of the state of Israel. Now, there's no doubt that the Western countries should push for a level of accountability, but it's completely lacking. It doesn't even have a board of directors that oversees it. Israel now says it has intelligence that more than 30 of the organization's employees, including many from the educational sector, actively participated in the murder spree on October 7th. Actively participated, coordinating abductions, supplying ammunition, and taking photographs at massacre sites. This intelligence also indicates that 12% of the UNRWA employees in Gaza were members of terrorist organizations. There are 13,000 UNRWA employees in Gaza, and 12% of them were members of terrorist organizations. UNRWA teachers have been uncovered praising terror attacks, sharing photos of dead Israelis, and glorifying Hamas terrorists. That is what UNRWA is doing in Gaza. Now, the UNRWA's teaching of hate seems to be spreading. For example, in Victoria, Australia, the Teachers for Palestine movement has been trying to promote UNRWA-like materials in schools. In other words, they're spreading anti-Israel, anti-Jewish propaganda into other countries. That is what UNRWA is doing. They give lessons on Palestine and they show the maps that describe the annexation by Israel. No mention of the numerous wars instigated by Israel's Arab neighbors, and they're doing a total read of history, and they ignore what happened in 1948, 1967, 1973. In other words, UNRWA employees in areas other than Gaza and other countries are spreading anti-Israel and anti-Jewish propaganda. This is happening in other Western countries. So is it any wonder there is a level of apathy around the UNRWA scandals because they teach hate and they promote violence, and they're being paid by the UN to do so? The UNRWA's educational system has produced thousands of barbaric terrorists who committed mass atrocities on Israeli civilians on October 7th. Any hope for peace, any hope of avoiding a repetition of the current Israel-Hamas war, needs that UNRWA not be allowed to do the same to future generations of Palestinian children. UNRWA should be stopped. It is a travesty that has brought only death to Israelis and to Palestinians. So the United Nations essentially has been using it a tool to create hate in the Palestinian area and is essentially part of the reason why this war is now happening. These are the facts on the ground, and it's something people have to know about. Now, I want to switch the subject and say a few words, totally different subject. I want to talk about the dependence that Israel now has on the United States for its defense. Israel depended up until 1967 on France. I know when I first came on Aliyah, I worked for Israel Aircraft Corporation. A lot of my fellow workers were working in France together with the French, and the IDF flew Mirage fighter jets, and they developed missiles, and even the Dimona nuclear reactor had its beginning in France. But then, under de Gaulle, there was a boycott against Israel, and that forced Israel into doing its own technological military work, and Israel has now become a superpower. It helped make Israel, the fact that France suddenly turned against Israel, helped make Israel one of the world's top 10 weapons exporters, where there was annual sales of Israeli weapons to other countries is $12 billion. So in order to survive, the Jewish state can only rely on itself, not on foreign assistance. Now, what's happened is something has happened with our relation with the United States. The systems that Israel wants to manufacture independently vary. There are air-to-ground bombs, assault rifles, tactical helmets and other things that are now being manufactured in Israel. So, but people should not get ahead of themselves as they did this week when they announced the announcement of a new line of assault rifles being built by Israel, because it's true that Israel is able to manufacture things, and Israel can create some measure of independence. It's not to the level that some people expect, especially when it comes to the United States. And this is a simple reason for this. Israel's army's reliance on U.S. military platforms is not just about explosive devices and things like that. When looking at the Israeli army today, the IDF, a lot of things are developed and manufactured in Israel, but half the procurement of weapons takes place outside of Israel. Almost every aircraft flown by the Israeli Air Force is American-made. This includes F-15s, F-16s, F-35s, Apache helicopters, Black Hawks, Sikorsky CH-53 Stallions, C-123s, refueling tankers, and more. So for an American administration to stop a war one day, it doesn't have to refrain from supplying simple things. All it has to do is stop the flow of spare parts for the fleet of airplanes that Israel has purchased from the United States. Because when a squadron is in combat, the planes require maintenance. It requires a steady and regular flow of spare parts. If the military doesn't have spare parts, it can be forced to ground It's airplanes. So it would be almost impossible to fight a sustained conflict today by Israel without active support from the United States. This is a fact, and we have to keep it in mind. I'll be back after the break.
Warning. Take cover. The Jewish Truth Bomb is here. The show that will explode all the false narratives and fake news. Join host Lenny Goldberg each week as he wires the news together and detonates it through biblical verses that will deliver a shockwave that will blow you away. Don't miss it. The Jewish Truth Bomb. Every Monday.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to say a few words about the education in the Palestinian Authority, and in general, not just the education, but the entire propaganda against the State of Israel. Several months before the October 7th attack, the most important Palestinian religious figure, a gentleman named Mahmoud al-Khabash, he is Abbas, his advisor on religious affairs. Abbas, of course, is the head of the Palestinian Authority, and he's the Palestinian Authority's top Sharia judge. In other words, he's the top religious guy in the Palestinian Authority, and he warned Palestinians about how dangerous the Jews are. He described Jews, and I quote, who as people who have left the path of humanity and followed Satan. Satan is not humanity. Satan does not have to be in the form of a demon hidden. He can also be in a person of a form of a person, but he is Satan in a form of a man. He is Satan. This is the official Palestinian Authority TV on July 7th, 2023, right before the war began. According to Islam, Satan is the source of all evil in the world. So fighting and killing the Jew, who is Satan, is not only an act of self-defense for Palestinians, but it also makes the world a safer place, because you must destroy Satan, and the Jews are Satan. In an earlier sermon, this same advisor to Abbas, he gave a sermon on the Temple Mount, and he said the Jews are creatures that Allah created in the form of humans, those whom Allah has cursed and with whom Allah became angry and made of them apes and pigs. In other words, according to this Muslim religious leader, the Jews are apes and pigs. And he urged Muslims to visit the Al-Aqsa Mosque so that it does not remain in the hands of these apes and pigs. And by the way, we are now entering the month of Ramadan, so the words of this religious leader are going to have an effect. Three times in the first half of 2023, official Palestinian Authority TV broadcast the opinions of Palestinian researcher named Muhammad al-Yahya, who explained, and I quote, that Jews are by nature arrogant, they don't accept others, the Europeans hated the Jews, and the Europeans wanted to get rid of the Jews, so the European countries had the idea of establishing a Jewish state for the Jews in order to get rid of the Jews from Europe. The Jewish thinking is based on racism that caused them to be hated everywhere, In the protocols of the elders of Zion, there is a sentence that they are fulfilling that has caused them to be hated by the people. The pure Jew has the outlook that he is a people chosen by God. And this is what this Palestinian religious leader said. On October 17th, after the war began, Palestinian political commentator named Kamal Zakarneh explained on Palestinian TV that Western nations support Israel because Europe and America succeeded in getting rid of the Jews, whom they themselves view as human waste, and they threw them out into Palestine. They don't want a weak Israel, which will cause reverse migration now, and the Jews may return to Europe again. The idea is to keep the Jews out of Europe. That is what the Europeans want, according to this Palestinian leader. So the bottom line is the Palestinian leadership has made it clear that the dehumanizing of Jews is not just a technical category, but something to be acted upon. The Palestinian Authority leaders present the murderers of Jews as Palestinian role models and heroes. Two Jews were killed, actually three, a woman named Lucy D and her two daughters were killed, and the killers were caught and killed by the Israeli forces in May of 2023. A Palestinian politician named Mohammed Shtaya posted the pictures of the murderers on his Facebook page and honored them and said, "Glory and eternity to our righteous martyrs." When Palestinian murderers were released from prison last year after 40 years in prison, Mahmoud Abbas had a video made of him calling them on the phone to say, "You are prominent figures among the Palestinian people. We are proud of you. You are models of this nation, models of this people. You are icons of the Palestinian people." In other words, if you murder Jews, you are an icon to the Palestinian people. So, in other words, the Jews are dehumanized, and this is what the Palestinians are taught. October 7th didn't happen in a vacuum. And years of successful Palestinian Authority indoctrination of the Palestinians has dehumanized Jews in the Palestinian perception, which made Palestinians believe that October 7th was proper moral behavior. Killing Jews is proper moral behavior. Palestinians trusted they were merely acting in self-defense on behalf of all humanity against the dangers and suffering caused by the Jews, who are Satan and are human waste. That is what the kids in the Palestinian Authority have been taught to believe. At a press conference accompanying the release of Palestinian Media Watch's report on Palestinian school books in the U.S. Senate back in 2007, Hillary Clinton, who was a senator then, said the Palestinians were profoundly poisoning the minds of their children. This has been going on for years since the Palestinian Authority came. It was brought here by our mistaken leaders, and they've been educating their kids for this long period of time that Jews are pigs. The United States has to understand, if they're seeking a solution, it cannot be achieved by merely treating the actions of October 7th as a one-time horrific isolated event. And by replacing Hamas's rule in Gaza with the rule of the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian Authority is no better than Hamas. It was the Palestinian Authority that poisoned two generations of Palestinians and created support for Hamas. Before anyone should talk about giving additional jurisdiction to the Palestinian Authority, Israel needs to see a fundamental and extended detoxification of Palestinians, a process that will take probably decades. Only then can Israel consider extending jurisdiction to the Palestinian Authority, and only then where there'll be a population with Israel can start a peace process. In other words, there is no chance for a peace process for at least two generations, or maybe 30 or 40 years, because all the kids who were raised under the Palestinian Authority, starting in 1995, have had their minds poisoned against the State of Israel. So I don't know how this present war is going to end, but you cannot allow the Palestinian Authority to retake the area in terms of the education and control the area, because all they will do is simply poison another generation of minds against the State of Israel and against Jews. So I don't know what's going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen. One thing is for sure, you cannot allow the Palestinian Authority to retake the control of the Gaza area when this war is over. The big question, what will be, but allowing them to take over will only bring us the same problem every few years. I want to say a couple, change the subject and say a couple more words about the United Nations. You know, the United Nations voted in 1949 to create the State of Israel. So you have to ask yourself, what's happened in all those years? Over time, the United Nations has developed some different standards on Israel, especially in relation to the settlements in the West Bank and in Gaza and the Golan Heights. Where was it determined that it's illegal for Jews to live in the heart of Jerusalem or Samaria and Judea? How is it that the United Nations has come so far from the point in 1949 when it created the State of Israel? That it was explicit at that time that Jewish people have a right to self-determination in our ancestral homeland, and now it's made them illegal. What has caused this change in policy? What are the driving forces that have brought this to pass in the UN? It turns out, if we look back, we see a series of what you can call turning points in terms of the UN's relationship with Israel. Firstly, the UN's current policy rejects Israel's annexation of Eastern Jerusalem after winning the 1967 Six-Day War. Secondly, the land regained by Israel in 1967 became known as occupied Palestinian territories. This has been established as a credible attitude. These territories are not Jewish anymore. They're Palestinian, according to the UN. And the word Palestinian has been appropriated to refer to anything non-Jewish. And it's important to emphasize that the 1948 Declaration of Israel's Statehood was thoroughly recognized by everybody. Particularly after the First World War, there was the San Remo Conference, the League of Nations, and then the UN. This precedent means legal empowerment and determines legitimacy in the exercise of authority and jurisdiction and the power to implement and safeguard this decision. So, following Israel's War of Independence, Jordan took over the West Bank, Egypt occupied Gaza, and Syria took over the Golan Heights. All of that is contrary to international law. The principle of inadmissibility of acquiring territory by force is now being used against Israel. But it should also apply to Jordan and Egypt for both taking over the West Bank and Gaza by force when they attacked Israel in 1948, and not the other way around. It was the illegality of what these nations did against Israel that is wrong. Israel did nothing illegal. In 1949, the same year that the Geneva Convention and the International Humanitarian Law for Protecting Civilians in Times of War were instituted, Israel was admitted as a member of the United Nations. The international community attributed to the Arab nations the responsibility for the hostile environment against the Jews. That was the official position of the UN Security Council. However, the subsequent victory of Israel over the Arab enemies, time and time again, has produced the international change of heart, in which the Jewish state was no longer perceived as a victim, but as the aggressor with the force and capacity to overcome its Arab enemies. The Jews have now become the aggressors. All for the fully recognized acceptance of the pre-existing legal rights that had been grounded in Israel changed. The existing legally binding rights and obligations that were created in 1948 have been replaced by differentiated singularization that points out the only Jewish state on the planet as being not the victim of attack, but rather being the aggressor. The state that represents the Jews globally, the state of Israel, was left in an international, unlawfully impossible situation. No UN member has ever brought a genocide case against China for what it's doing in Tibet, or against Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. There's something special when it comes to the Jews and to Israel, and the Jews are now seen as the oppressors rather than the victims. And this really raises a question about the legitimacy of the UN. However, to eliminate an organization like that, doesn't sound like a solution. We're not going to get rid of the UN. The UN is there. As a member institution of the UN, did the World Food and Agriculture Organization ever manage to eliminate famine in Africa or Asia or anywhere? That an immense amount of time, energy, and money is spent by the UN in attacking Israel? And Israel is a country at the forefront of research and improvement in food production, which can be used by the whole world. So, what would have been the achievements of UNESCO, for example, had it educated Palestinian children? Did it prevent educating several generations to hate Jews, martyrdom, and murderous terrorism? The UN is responsible for the education in the Palestinian areas, and they have created, essentially, this monster that Israel now has to deal with. Did the Security Council ever do anything to prevent acts of terror and bombing of Israel coming from Lebanon or Syria or Judea, Samaria, Gaza, and now Yemen? How long did it take the UN to react in the face of the October massacre? Nothing. They've done nothing. What would be the purpose of an international court of justice that has never prosecuted the terrorist groups or countries that finance these groups? Meanwhile, all these UN-affiliated organizations are led by countries in the UN who have the least suitable countries to chair these organizations. The UN are undistributed books that taught children to hate and kill Jews, and many copies of Hitler's Mein Kampf printed in Arabic with its trademark were found all over Gaza in this present war. And the UNRWA employees helped to store quantities of explosives and weapons in Gaza. The crux of this whole anti-Israel question is that of balancing Palestinian rights to self-determination and resolution of Palestinian refugees. Israel has a problem because the UN has treated Israel differently than it treats the rest of the world, and we're now living with the results of that. The UN has created a conceptual mishmash, and we are now fighting the results of what the UN did.
Okay, that's all for this week. Thanks for listening. This is Jay Shapiro signing off until next week.